with a Court with Class program that is a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. Under this program, all the high school classes are invited to come and participate with us in oral argument. And for the classes who accept this invitation, we send the briefs, and the students will read the briefs and other materials and perhaps meet with lawyers about the case. And then they come here for oral argument, and then at noon, the students will meet with a justice of this court. And we've met you. Let me introduce the justices to you. On my far left is Justice Patience Robinsack. She is the justice with whom you will meet at noon today. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, mix that up because Prosser used to sit there. That is Justice, and he's been very good and quiet, not correcting me. What is your name?
George Schultz.
His name is Justice Pat Crooks. I hope you'll all remember that. Pat Crooks, even if I can't remember it. Not seated on the far right today, is Justice Diane Sykes, who could not be with us. So, with those introductions made, I will call our second case for today, 02-2642W, State X Rel Shannon Levine versus Stephen Puckett. Arguing for the petitioner is Nicholas C. and is it Zales? Arguing for Stephen Puckett is Assistant Attorney General David E. Hall. Mr. Zales. Mr. Zales, in our ordinary procedure here, we give counsel sort of a free time of about 5 minutes to state his case without being interrupted by questions. I'm going to change the procedure today for you.
That's fine.
And what I want, the reason I'm changing that practice is because in an unusual manner, you and the state, Mr. Puckett, seem to agree as to the answer to the question that this court posed to each of you.
That's correct.
That's correct. Yet you indicated that oral argument is terribly important. So here's my question to you. What exactly do you want this court to do for your client? Let's just get to the bottom line. If you agree on the answer to the question, does your client therefore lose, and therefore he's out of court because he didn't pay a fee, and the trial court said, in effect, he did not state a claim? Is that what the result is here? What's the result in this case?
Well, the question before us is the interpretation of the statute.
I understand that. You agree that he's not a prisoner. What is the result that's going to happen to your client?
Okay, the fundamental difference is that by not being a prisoner, anyone who is convicted in Wisconsin and then is serving their sentence in another state, if something happens that they want to complain about, or say in prison they are not don't get something they want, they can file a petition for a writ of certiorari with the circuit court, and they can state that the prison officials made a mistake and complain about it. The fundamental difference is that in-state prisoners in Wisconsin have 45 days from the date of that action by the corrections officials to file that petition. whereas prisoners out of state have 6 months under common law certiorari.
Okay. So that was the Safford case. Okay. What did your client file timely?
Yes.
So what's his complaint? I don't want to know his complaint. I want to know if we hold the way you said, isn't your client out of luck? Isn't your client, you just affirm the Court of Appeals, affirm the Circuit Court, and your client is can't bring this petition for cert. Isn't that the result of your brief?
Yes, in this instance, but there's more to it than that.
Okay, in this instance, your client loses.
That's correct.
Period.
Buddy?
Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, so what's more to it?
Well, in the future.
All right.
The next time he comes up for review, he wants to be moved to a different part of the prison or be brought back to Wisconsin from the Minnesota prison he's in now, he would have 6 months to prepare such a petition to the circuit court, mm-hmm. whereas if the court was to construe the statute differently, he would only have 45 days.
So you're protecting some future matter that he might bring. Is that what you're doing here?
Exactly, but
and so you want us to really affirm Safford versus Schwartz? Is that it?
Yes, although I think the leading action before that was the Spiener versus Gudmundsen
okay.
case, which was
fine.
The fourth but
Safford was right on this point.
All right, counsel, let me just ask, because if is he a prisoner, or are you arguing he is or is not a prisoner? You're saying he is a prisoner, correct?
That's the difficulty in this case, Justice Wilcox, is that the word in law, sometimes, most of the time, words have their ordinary meaning. But sometimes the legislature acts and creates specific definitions of terms. And that's what's happened in this case.
I guess the reason I'm asking is that, and this is, the Chief Justice asked those prefatory questions, and mine is, if he is a prisoner, then he would fall under the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act, and wouldn't that if he is a prisoner and he'd fall under that, wouldn't he be subjecting himself and other out-of-state prisoners to the requirements of that? Wouldn't he fall under PLRA?
Exactly. That is the larger instance in this case.
Is that something you think other out-of-state prisoners would want to do, fall under the PLRA?
I'm pretty sure they would not.
So your argument, as you responded to the Chief Justice, is that you're agreeing here, well, the certified question is, you addressed, and you're agreeing with the state that Spiener is controlling, correct?
Yes.
But you're looking down the road, as you say.
Exactly, and I'm here, in addition to representing Mr. Levine, every prisoner, or every person who's incarcerated out of the state of Wisconsin.
But that was my question on how the PLRA would, how it would be accounted for here. And if we adopt, in other words, if he becomes a prisoner, then he would fall under that. And that has certain, there are certain restrictions under that. Do you think that would be beneficial to out-of-state prisoners?
No, I do not.
Okay.
Primarily because of the limited time that they have, the 45 days time. And I know part of the difficulty here is the word prisoner.
That's what confuses me about the argument.
Mr. Zales, in baseball, if a person gets a hit, the first person up gets a hit, a single, and the second person comes up and the manager says, sacrifice the runner over to second base. Then the second batter is deliberately trying to make an out in order to advance the runner. Have you been authorized to sacrifice Mr. Zales for the larger good of all these other prisoners?
I don't understand what you mean by the sacrifice. I understand the baseball terminology. I'm familiar with that. But I don't see how, I think Mr. Levine's interests are the same as all people incarcerated out of state under Wisconsin sentences.
Well, I'll put it differently, but it's essentially the same. You are agreeing that he loses in this case. That is comparable to the bunt and sacrifice, if I can analogize. And you are appearing, to say, well, in the future, my client might want to do something else. He's going to be up at bat again. And that when he's up in bat again, he wants to not have his sacrifice held against him, because his sacrifice is going to let the team win and he's going to get a bigger bonus when they get into the World Series. Isn't your case moot? You've agreed that he loses here.
Well, no.
Why isn't your case moot?
No, if I could clarify why it's not moot.
And right.
What happened was, in the beginning, Mr. Levine filed his petition with the circuit court. He complained that the Minnesota the prison officials there had disciplined him, and that was part of a record that the state of Wisconsin officials used to deny his request to be moved to a lesser security prison. The circuit court looked into that and denied that. The Court of Appeals looked at that and denied that. I think he made meritorious arguments there.
But that's not before this court.
That's exactly the problem, which is I'm trying to address.
But if it's not,
is that in terms of losing, what's happened is here we are at this court, which is the lawmaking court, which is using Mr. Levine's petition to examine the statute. And it said specifically in your order, you said, the court does not want to look at the merits of the discipline and all that. And so in terms of you say losing, I don't know really what could be, well, he could lose if the court was to construe the statute the other way as to the future, as to how long they have to file petitions.
The Court of Appeals in its decision relied on Spener to say he's not a prisoner.
Yes.
So you are in effect affirming or asking this court to affirm the Court of Appeals, right?
Yes, I am.
And he loses. Your client loses. This case, he loses. Is that right?
At this level, that's correct.
Right. Well, do you have another level?
Well, if the court had granted the petition in a broader way,
yeah,
and wanted to address the merits.
But it didn't.
Right.
It didn't do that. Let me tell you what I thought you were going to argue. I thought that you were going to argue that on the basis of precedent, Spener and Forwith and Froworth and Safford versus Schwartz, I thought you were going to argue he is not a prisoner under these statutes. He is not. But if you follow that precedent, and if you so interpret these statutes, then these statutes violate your client's equal protection or due process rights. They're unfair. Why are they unfair? They are unfair, and the legislature could not have possibly intended that for this fact situation. Because had he been on this side of the Wisconsin border, he could get one free ride with the judge. No fee, and he wouldn't be out of court, even if he didn't state a claim, right?
To a point, yes, that is correct.
That's right. Because even if he didn't state a claim for on which relief could be granted, he'd be docketed. His petition would be docketed. He's 3 miles over in the Minnesota border, sitting in a Minnesota private institution under a Wisconsin conviction. And he doesn't get that one shot. And there is no difference between these two people other than the state of incarceration, right? The state where he is incarcerated.
That's correct.
This is what I expected. Therefore, there is no rational basis for differentiating on those 3 miles. Now, there's a rational basis under Safford versus Schwartz for differentiating between in-state and out-state prisoners, giving the out-state prisoner more time because less access to Wisconsin law, less access to Wisconsin lawyers. You give them more time. It's rational. But I thought you'd argue there is no rational basis for differentiating in this case on these facts for this aspect of the law. You're not attacking every other part of the law. Generally, Spina is fine. No problem. But here, applying it to this fact situation and this aspect of the law is unfair, contrary to due process, contrary to equal protection, with no rational basis for distinguishing between an in-state prisoner and an out-state prisoner. That's what I thought you could argue.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Think of that argument.
I did.
You would have had me.
I did make some. I think in both cases, whether you're in-state or out-state, at one point the circuit court has got to look at the merits of the petition. And in this case, the court did look at the merits and asked him to provide more information, which he did, but the circuit court found it was not sufficient. If he was in-state, they wouldn't have looked at that initially, but it would have had to have been looked at some time.
Right. So you get one free shot, in effect, under the statute, an in-state prisoner. You get to get your thing filed, your petition filed, without the circuit court being a gatekeeper. But sooner or later, that circuit court's going to rule on whether a claim has been stated. Right?
Exactly.
So the only thing the statute does is give you one free shot.
It does, and the time differential for filing the petition.
I know, but your client has no beef on that. He filed timely, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what's the matter with my argument? Or do you accept my argument?
I do to differ with one point, and that is okay. That the circuit court at some time must look at the merits of the petitions. And part of the Wisconsin Litigation Reform Act, 1977, was to reduce prisoner litigation, reduce the burden on the circuit court system.
Right.
So you have the one side that gets the one that gets to file the free petition and get the case going.
Right.
And then the judge looks at it, the circuit court
right.
judge, and says there's merit or no merit.
Right.
Here, the way it is, my client had to go through the merit test initially. He didn't get
that's
that
right.
free
that's right.
filing. But I don't know how that really benefits people to get a free one-time filing if there's no merit to their claims.
Right.
I think they're taking up the time of the circuit court, which is going to have to look at it anyway.
So you don't like my argument because it's sort of irrelevant, because under any condition, you don't think the one free shot is worth the effort?
I do think it is worth the effort, but as a lawyer of 14 years' experience and a judicial law clerk at the circuit court, I also feel there's a good argument on the other side that the court's going to have to deal with this sometime or other.
So there's really no real harm to your client, you're saying, in response to my argument, whether he gets the free shot initially or gets the free shot a few weeks later.
Well, the one benefit of the free shot is that when the matter is filed with the circuit court, then it's going to be there, the case is started, and the judge must look at it.
Right.
And so our busy judges, they will have a little bit more time to look at that particular
right.
petition and see if there's merit to it. Whereas on the other side, if they can just get at it right away initially and kick it out and say, oh, no, there's no merit to this, they might not spend as much time on that. Now, I don't want to speak for every judge in the state. I'm sure they all do a good job on these. But having a matter started on the court's docket is certainly preferable to being kicked out initially, because then you're nowhere.
Okay, so that supports my argument. You seem to be arguing both ways.
Yes, that's all right. We're here to help the court because the court makes the law. And I think the best way to make the law is to have a full discussion of all the sides of the issues. This isn't a trial where I'm trying to convince a jury about I know this or that or we know what trials can be. This is here at the Supreme Court, and you are all making the law. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's my obligation to bring all sides of the argument to bear.
Oh, we appreciate that, counsel.
It is difficult, as to say, but as a practical matter, it's hard to say. There is merit to having the free shot, the one time, because then it is, as I said, and where is it? Although in my particular case here, I do credit the trial court judge. It was Daniel Moser. And he did inquire. He looked at it, and then he wrote a letter to my client and said, would you please provide me with some more information? Mm-hmm. He didn't have to do that, but he did. And my client sent more information to him, but that wasn't sufficient. But that was at least two times that he looked at it. And I credit the judge for doing that. That's commendable. That's perhaps more than might happen in other cases. There's counties where people are busier.
Where is Mr. Labine now?
He's being held at the Prairie Correctional Facility, which is in a city called Appleton, Minnesota.
I mean, has his status changed at all?
No, it has not. I believe it's a medium security facility, or the part of it that he's being held at is medium security. And he would like to be upgraded to a lesser security facility. And he also would like to be moved back to the state of Wisconsin. He is serving a life sentence, convicted of two felonies in 1993, and received a life sentence. And I believe that part of that is that he wants to be back in Wisconsin at some time. Another part of it is that he wants to be in a lesser secure part of the prison. And also he didn't like the fact that the Minnesota correctional officials had their own methods of discipline, and putting that on his record, which could be different from what would the discipline that is imposed in Wisconsin would be. And that would go back to Justice Abrahamson's argument. Why would we want to treat people differently if they're both two Wisconsin prisoners? One's in Wisconsin, one's in Minnesota. They should be treated the same.
But you see, now on that, counsel, I think you could argue that if you're in a Minnesota institution, you have to abide by the Minnesota rules, that you can't have separate rules for Wisconsin prisoners, Iowa prisoners, Texas prisoners, all in the Minnesota prison. But that doesn't, there's a rational basis for treating them all the same and not abiding by Wisconsin prison discipline rules.
Exactly. But the problem with that is that perhaps something that would warrant discipline in Minnesota might not warrant discipline in Wisconsin.
That's right.
And as a matter for his record, when prison officials look at this to determine whether to change his placement, if he has a record from Minnesota where things are violations there that are not violations here.
But that issue is not before us.
No, it's not.
Okay.
I'm not sure I remember exactly when the review committee made its decision in this case, but I know Judge Moser was 25th of September 2002. Certainly at least a year has passed. Has he been reviewed again? Do you know? Or
I think that happens every 3 years. But I'm not an expert on criminal law, and so I don't know exactly. Perhaps Attorney Hole might know. But that, but I do not believe he has been.
Much. Okay.
Are there any further questions? Is there anything else you'd like to say? Your orange light is on, but that you will have approximately 3 or 4 minutes.
I enjoy taking the questions from the court more than talking myself, I must say. I do want to say that we are here today because the court granted the petition to look at this statute and determine whether people incarcerated in out-of-state facilities are prisoners, quote, prisoners or not, and then subject to the two acts. And I know when I read the Spiener case, and mistakenly, when I first got this file, I picked up the Spiener case and read that, and I thought that I was going to be trying to overturn that decision, And I looked at this and I said, this is going to be very difficult. This is a very well-reasoned case. It's very logical. And then when I put it down, picked up the rest of the file, I realized that that was on our side. And so, and I do believe that the Speener case is 4 years old now, come next month. And the holding of that case is that any facility that a Wisconsin prisoner is being held in out of state, whether it be public or private, is not a correctional institution as defined by the legislature. And I think there's, and part of the Speener case is they found the term, is it any state or local facility, ambiguous. And I thought perhaps this court might find that that term was ambiguous also and want to engage in a statutory analysis to discern the legislative intent. And I would just like to say that I do think that everything is laid out in the Speener case, that would be my argument, that had the legislature intended to treat everybody the same, they would have said so. But the analysis there, I think, is very interesting. And I also wanted to touch on the fact that the legislature has not introduced any, or nobody has introduced any remedial legislation that would change that statutory interpretation that the Speener court made. And although the inaction of the legislature does not control this court's analysis, but it is a fact to consider. I mean, simply just because the legislature doesn't enact legislation in response to a court decision does not mean the legislature agrees with it, because there's many factors that go into making legislation. But it is something to look at, and that was the one comment that I wanted to make. Okay.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in the rebuttal. Mr. Hull, Assistant Attorney General, representing Stephen Puckett.
May it please the court, my name is David Hull. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I represent Mr. Puckett. Mr. Puckett is the director of the Department of Corrections Bureau of Offender Classification and Movement. This is likely to be the least contentious case of the term, as far as I can tell.
Well, not after we finish with you.
I hadn't anticipated that, Your Honor. The parties have come to the same general conclusion on the question that was certified by the court, that question being, is a Wisconsin inmate who is confined to a private out-of-state facility a prisoner for purposes of the PLRA? This turns, of course, on the specific definitional sections of Section 801.027A1 and 2. And it is a portion of the question that this court reserved in the Kramer case. The answer to that question that the court has certified is no. The parties, though, have come to that answer by slightly different approaches. Mr. Zales relies heavily on the Speener case. We rely more on common law construction tools. Why we have this difference, I think, is first off, this court is not bound by Speener. This court will, in fact, look at this particular question de novo because it is an interpretation of state law.
You don't view this court as, you don't view the Court of Appeals as precedent for this court either?
Your Honor, the Court of Appeals is precedent as regards me, as regards the circuit courts, and as regards the Court of Appeals, but it is not binding upon this court. This court may, in fact, reverse a rule of the Court of Appeals.
But we can reverse our own rules, too.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what's the difference?
The difference is that this court would take a look at the rationale of Speener as set forth by the Court of Appeals and decide whether that particular rationale should be the rationale that informs the law of the state of Wisconsin.
Okay.
The other problem with Speener is that Speener is different from this case. Speener dealt with an inmate who was confined to a public institution. That is a Texas county jail. Mr. Labine is confined to a private institution. That is an institution run by the Corrections Corporation of America in Appleton, Minnesota. The answer to the court's question may be different depending on whether we have a Wisconsin inmate confined in a private institution as opposed to a publicly run institution.
Why?
The difference comes from the definitional section in 801.027A1. That definitional section refers to prisoners as people who are confined in any state or local facility. The Court of Appeals may, in fact, have been wrong when it determined that any state or local facility does not include a public facility which is located out of state. The second problem comes from the second sentence in section 801.02(7)(A1). That second sentence gives, I hesitate to use the word examples because I don't think they are examples. What they are included types of institutions which are come within the definition of state and local facilities. These include a type one prison, type two prison, county jail, and houses of correction. Type one prisons are in fact defined by law as being certain type of facilities, though not entirely bricks and mortar type of institutions. But they are very clearly under the statutes included within DOC's statutory authority to run and establish institutions. Type 2 institutions, there's only one type of institution, and that is, in fact, the intensive sanctions program, which is a program, not a bricks and mortar institution, but it is a prison pursuant to the definition of the legislature. County jails exist all over this country. They are public institutions. A house of correction, while it is a specific term used to a Milwaukee facility in this state, the Court of Appeals also found that there are houses of correction in other states in the Spener decision. Therefore, reading the definition in 801.027A1, the Court of Appeals may in fact have erred in stating that Wisconsin inmates in out-of-state institutions that are publicly run are in fact not prisoners. That is not the case before the court today. And so we would respectfully urge the court to limit its decision to the type of prisoner and the type of institution which is specifically before the court, and to once again reserve for another day the second part of the question that was reserved in Kramer.
That would be the question
of whether Wisconsin inmates confined to publicly run institutions out of state are in fact prisoners under the PLRA.
So you just want us to deal with private prisoners or not under the statute, are not prisoners.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Because they don't fall within correctional institution as defined by 7A1.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the Spener case found that definition with regard to inmates in private institutions to be unambiguous. With respect to publicly run institutions out of state, the Court of Appeals did in fact find the definition to be ambiguous. With respect, to clarify this a little bit more, with respect to the Spener case, when it talked about private institutions out of state, essentially that was dicta. That did not control its actual decision.
It didn't control, but you know the general rule, although there are exceptions, is that there's no such thing as dicta in this state.
I've heard of that theory, Your Honor.
We've got cases going both ways, as you know.
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Okay.
Is it your interpretation that if a prisoner is in a If a prisoner were in a privately owned and operated facility in Wisconsin or Minnesota or Texas or anywhere else, the rules in terms of filing fees would be different from the rules if they were in a public institution, either in Minnesota or Wisconsin?
The rule would depend upon the definitional section, again, in 801.02, parent 7, parent A1 and 2. Private institutions outside of the state of Wisconsin would, in fact, those people would not be prisoners. With respect to inmates who are confined within private institutions within the state of Wisconsin, I think the problem you would then reach is whether those private institutions are included within the definition of type 1 or type 2 prison.
Are they?
It is possible that they could be. If, for example, if you would think of a secure holding facility, a private secure holding facility that a inmate was assigned to as part of a sanction under the intensive sanctions program. Well, the intensive sanctions program is specifically a type 2 prison, and therefore I would interpret that as being, regardless of whether it was privately run or regardless of where the prisoner actually was housed, he would still be a prisoner because he would be under the intensive sanctions program, which is a type 2 prison.
Now, why does this make any sense?
Why does it make any sense?
Why would you say prisoner that's in a private institution in Minnesota is treated for purposes of this waiver of fee differently than a prisoner in a public institution in Minnesota? Why would you say that a prisoner in Wisconsin in a public institution is treated differently for purposes of waiver of fee than a prisoner in a private institution in Wisconsin? If the legislature makes distinctions, it has to have a rational reason for doing it. Doesn't have to be much of a reason, but there has to be some reason. How do you distinguish among these four types of prison? Private out, private in, public out, in.
I think that how you distinguish them is the way that the Court of Appeals distinguished them in Safford. I think that the Court of Appeals came to a rational distinction there that inmates in in-state institutions may have, in fact, better access to Wisconsin legal materials than those in out-of-state.
Right.
The
I
court,
agree.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I agree. All right. So what's your distinction here?
I think that the legislature could also have come to a rational distinction that inmates who were in public institutions out of state would also have better access to legal materials in general than those inmates who were confined to private institutions.
That may be with regard to public and private distinction. But now let's deal with in-state and out-state distinction, regardless of whether they're public or private. What's the rational basis for treating differently the people incarcerated differently here, based on state boundary?
Well, in the administrative code, there's laid out what particular legal resources have to be provided by state prisons to their inmates. Also, some state prisons have taken it upon themselves to allow prisoners in certain security classifications to access electronic media for their legal research.
I think I'm not making my question clear. Let me just try to amplify it to get to my point. Certainly in the Saffolk case, there was a rational basis given, and that deals with what you're talking about. That is resources and access to libraries. When you're talking about the date on which a petition for a writ of cert has to be filed, 45 days versus the common law, 6 months. Makes sense to me that those that are, if you will, under a disability of distance and perhaps less ability for access, that there's a rational basis there to treat them differently. But here we have a different factual situation. What's the rational basis for treating those who are housed out of state differently from those who are housed in state with regard to whether or not they have to state a claim upon which relief can be granted in order to get a waiver of filing fees?
Well, the distinction is essentially one between prisoners under the PLRA and everyone else. So essentially, a person who comes off the street who's not a prisoner, who doesn't have money, the court then looks specifically at their actual complaint to see if it states a claim. Whereas first of all, if you're a prisoner, the court will, in fact, let you file the claim and will then proceed to determine whether it states a claim or not.
I know that they are treated, I know that the statute allows, I mean, I'll advance that the statute allows different treatment. And when you interpret the statute, they are treated differently. My question, though, is in this fact situation with regard to filing fee, what rational basis is there? What governmental interest is being promoted with regard to failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted in the context of waiver of fees?
I think it has to do with the three strikes provision, Your Honor. If you're a prisoner under the PLRA, then you get your complaint filed, then the court reads the complaint to determine whether it states a claim or not. If it doesn't state a claim, it counts as a strike towards your inability to again access the court system in a fee waiver situation. If you are not a prisoner under the PLRA, what happens is that right up front, the court will examine your complaint and not allow it to be filed. So if you don't state a claim and you're not a prisoner under the PLRA, then you don't get a strike. All that happens is that your complaint does not get filed. So if you are a prisoner under the PLRA, then you can be disadvantaged by the process as opposed to people who are not prisoners.
Okay. So you think this whole thing relates to the PRLA and the strikes, and that it's designed to put into effect curbs on people who are institutionalized. I'm getting away from the term prisoner. People who are institutionalized from filing too many claims. That's the whole rationale for this waiver of fee?
Well, I think if you put that together with SAFL, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. I'm going to really state Justice Bradley's question in a different way. Yeah. You've got someone in a private institution in Minnesota, and it's rational to believe that a private institution will have less library and less facilities than a public institution. That's because it won't be governed by the same administrative code. Is that right?
I think that could be a rational basis, yes,
right,
Your Honor.
So we're saying that a person in a private institution under this statute is held to a higher standard than one in a Wisconsin public institution and therefore does not get one free shot at the court. That is, can't file it without gatekeeping, right?
No, Your Honor. They're not held to a higher standard, but the consequences for
consequences
prisoners
are
worse.
Consequences are worse for a guy who's less facilities than for a guy with facilities?
No, with a person for more facilities than with less facilities.
Person with less facilities has a disadvantage, right?
No, has an advantage.
What's the advantage?
The advantage is that you can file your complaint and a fee waiver request. The court will first off take a look at your complaint to see if it states a claim. If it doesn't, then the complaint is not filed and you wouldn't get a strike.
Do you ever get a strike if you're in from an out-of-state institution?
You would get a strike if, theoretically, you would get a strike you would get a strike if you were a prisoner. And
by your definition, you're not a prisoner if you're in a private out-of-state institution.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so that, it's an advantage you don't get a strike, but you'd never get a strike because you're not under the definition of prisoner.
Under Spiner, that's correct, Your Honor.
That's right. So your disadvantage is you don't get your petition docketed, right?
Well, that could be an advantage if you don't state a claim.
Well, it's not an advantage. I want to get the court to look at it more carefully. I want to get a right to, I want to file a brief.
Well, the difference then would be if the court didn't allow you to file the actual complaint, it's not a dismissal with prejudice. You can come back and you could file it again if you state a claim, or you can come back and file it again if you have some money. If the court dismisses your action after it's been docketed, it's usually a decision on the merits, and you have lost your ability to bring that action.
And there's no limit on the number of times you can bring this claim? If you're a private out-of-state?
I don't know that there is, Your Honor, because there's been no dismissal with prejudice.
Well, I've seen circuit court rules that say I've dismissed this three times, you are not allowed to bring it back.
The court could make that determination if it said, I've allowed you to amend once, I've allowed you to amend twice. It doesn't appear that you are going to be able to amend in order to state a claim. Then the court could certainly say, I'm not going to docket this or I'm not going to accept it.
You think this is an important case for the state of Wisconsin?
It's an important case in the sense that this definitional section, 801.02 parent 7, parent A, affects several other provisions of the PLRA. Mr. Zales has talked about how it affects the whether you have 45 days or the common law 6 months to file a certiorari action. And that's one of the reasons why we would urge the court to simply limit its ruling to what we have briefed here and what the court's certified question was, that is, concerning an inmate in this out-of-state private institution.
No, it doesn't say that. You see, that is not the question. The question is, who is currently serving a Wisconsin prison sentence in an out-of-state, not this one, an out-of-state correctional facility? It doesn't limit it to private or public. It doesn't limit it to this. Now, it does say the petitioner, but it's a very broad question. That's one of the problems I am having with the case. You're limiting this to a private institution out of the state and want us to say it's not a prisoner, therefore doesn't get that benefit, and not go further because you want to have an opportunity in the next case to see how it applies in another particular fact situation. Isn't that the issue?
Your Honor, from my own standpoint, the issue, I believe I read the court's order saying is the petitioner, and I thought that it was limited to this particular petitioner, Your Honor.
All right. So you're limiting the question, and you don't want to go further because you don't know what the next fact situation is going to be like, and then want to have an opportunity there to see whether it's better that he is or is not a prisoner. Isn't that the point?
No, Your Honor. I believe that this particular issue with respect to public out-of-state institutions would benefit from a full briefing by both sides.
And review again Spener, then?
And review Spener. That's correct, Your Honor.
I can't remember what position the state took in the Kramer case a few years ago with respect to the question of whether out-of-state people in out-of-state facilities were under PLRA. What position did the state take?
I believe the position the state took was that I'm not entirely sure because I didn't do Spener. I know what the court did is the court reserved the question because it felt that it wasn't squarely presented in Kramer because Mr. Kramer was, in fact, a prisoner of the Dane County Jail. I believe that the position of our office was that out-of-state placements, inmates placed out-of-state, were, in fact, still prisoners.
That was your position, you think?
I believe that was what it was. But I can check, and I can let the court know if you'd like me to do that.
It sure makes sense to treat them all the same, except where it would be unfair because of placement outside, like in Safford. Yes? No?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Would make sense if the legislature treated all prisoners in or out of the state the same, except where there's a good reason for not treating them the same, like discipline within the institution or timing, like in Safford.
Your Honor, from our standpoint, we can only argue what the legislature has actually written, and we can only argue on the basis of what they've written, what we think the rules should be on the basis of common law construction tools. And this is our answer. This is the best answer that we can provide to the court.
In preparing for today and reading the briefs and seeing the reply and response that maybe oral arguments aren't even necessary, do it on the briefs and the prefatory comment that you set forth of this may be a unique case where both sides agree. I was thinking about that as I was reading the briefs and, you know, looking for the beef here, so to speak. And it crossed my mind that maybe we should improvidently grant this case. In other words, indicate that this case has been improvidently granted and not write an opinion. What do you think about that?
On the basis of mootness, Your Honor, or on the basis that there's no controversy?
No controversy.
Your Honor, I think that the issue is important enough for the court to write a decision on the issue.
I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt you, so continue.
No, I'm sorry, that was in fact my answer.
Okay. But as I recall reading your opposing counsel's brief, he doesn't tackle this public-private stuff at all, which is your main thesis here, it seems to be, or your main concern.
Your Honor, my main concern because of my reading of the question certified by the court.
I mean, I actually read opposing counsel's brief a couple of times, and he doesn't deal with this public-private. He doesn't brief this public-private distinction and the efficacy of that distinction with regard to this law.
That's correct, Your Honor, because my understanding of his brief is that he relied heavily on the Spener decision.
Right.
other thing that bothers me in terms of without adversary briefs dealing with this is your concern seems to be the effect of the PLRA on private out-of-state prisoners. Yet, except for, I think, on page 7 of your brief, I don't see, and I don't, this is not meant to be critical of your brief, but if that's the driving force here, or a driving force, there isn't a careful discussion in either of the briefs about the effect of a decision in this case on that act.
You mean on how the the court's decision on the definitional section will affect how the act works?
Yes, because that's one of your bases for the rational basis here is how it affects the three-strike rule on the act. And so it would seem to me that the consequences of a decision would have to be for more fully explored. That's the rational basis.
Your Honor, once again, I think that when I wrote my brief, I wrote it because I thought that the court had limited the certified question.
You're absolutely right. We're trying to explore, and I will love to make counsel at ease. I accept, although I did not necessarily draft this or approve it only myself, I accept on behalf of the court responsibility for the drafting of this question. And now that I am wiser, I would have at least requested that the question be drafted better. How would you have drafted the question now that you are wiser, too?
Now that I'm wiser, the only way that I can think of answering that is to answer it in light of the Kramer decision. Because as I understand from reading Kramer, the court reserved the question as to whether any inmate housed in an out-of-state facility, whether private or public, was in fact a prisoner under the PLRA. And that is how I understand Kramer.
Now, Kramer is a 2000 decision, comes out very shortly after Spener, and I can't even remember if Kramer referred to Spener.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did they?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And it also referred to Froworth, Your Honor.
Right, and it just said we don't reach that.
I think the court specifically said it would reserve that question for a later date.
I have the sense, Mr. Cole, that this case is sort of like a loose thread, and both counsel are afraid that the court is going to pull that thread because it's sort of, you know, it just doesn't look quite right. And neither one of you knows quite what the damage will be if we pull that thread. Would that be a fair characterization?
Your Honor, I think a fair characterization would be the language in the court's order to us, which said that the court would not entertain arguments about the merits of this case. And I think, I can't speak for Mr. Zales, but for myself, I think I read that order saying you better stick to the question and not embroider on it. And that's exactly what I did.
So don't embroider that thread, but you can bunt and sacrifice. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Zales, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You're going to bunt or you're going to embroider?
I'm trying to hit a home run here.
Try that, even though your client loses, as I understand it.
I'd like to touch on a couple of the comments, Justice Braley, In the briefing process, the petitioner always goes first, and then respondent second, and then the petitioner gets the final reply brief. And again, as Mr. Hull said, I agree that that order from the court said, this is what we want to look at, no more. And I took that literally. One technique in an appeal many times is you will file your initial brief and you'll make many arguments, and then you wait for their response to see which ones the other side focuses in on, and then your final reply brief, you focus in on those even more. And had the state of Wisconsin brought up in their brief and said, well, there's a dichotomy between out-of-state public institutions and private ones, then I would have filed a reply brief and addressed that issue. In this case, when I received the state's brief, and since they agreed with me, I submitted a letter to the court by rule saying I'm not going to file a reply brief because it wouldn't make any sense to argue with myself. I think it's important that this court issue a decision, because right now the state of the law is the Spener case. Spener didn't make any distinction between out-of-state, private, and public facilities, and that is the law of Wisconsin. Spener's been cited 3 times now by other courts of appeals, but this court has not ruled on the statutory scheme, and I think it's important that this court do that. I also don't think it should limit itself. I think the court should make its decision as broad as possible, because I believe that these privately run jail facilities in other states are the functional equivalent of public institutions.
Here, are you saying then you want us to tackle this private public distinction that you didn't address or brief?
Yes, I am, because I don't really think that there is that much of a distinction to be made. And I don't really know that any future fact situation would be any different, other than you might have a prisoner in a public institution in Minnesota bringing this forward to the court. And also, as a lawyer, I know how long it takes for cases to get to the Supreme Court. It can take many years, and that's why it's a great honor to be here right now. And as a lawyer, and I want to read cases and see what the rules of law are, I always prefer when the court makes a broader decision, settles issues, so then we can move forward.
Well, you've relied heavily on Spener. It seems to me your first reason you've given that you want us to write a decision in this case is so that we speak on it, even though we might say exactly the same thing as Spener says, just for the value of our imprimatur being added to the jurisprudence. I mean, that's what I hear you saying. Am I right or wrong?
No, you're exactly right, Justice. I mean, this court is the highest court in the state of Wisconsin, and the weight accorded to its decisions control over any courts of appeals decisions. And you've taken the time to have us brief this issue, and we are here today discussing it. And I think it's important to have a court issue a decision, even if it is simply saying, well, we agree with the Spener decision, we agree with the logic, we agree that with all of its rationale. Because undoubtedly, I know that this court might add on to that, might think of other reasons. Even in agreeing with Spener, there might be other reasons that would provide guidance and benefit to the lower courts and to attorneys. And if there's no other questions, then thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Zales. That concludes our argument in 02-2642W in State X Rel Shannon Levine versus Stephen Puckett. And counsel correct, it's not usual for us to get agreement by both parties as to the ultimate law and also as to the ultimate result, and with both parties wondering and worrying about the consequences thereof. So it's been a very different and interesting argument. The students should remain here, and Justice Rogensack will be out in a few minutes to speak with you. Everyone here is cordially invited to stay and listen to the discussion. It is not limited merely to students. The discussion will be on procedure, not the substance of this case. The marshal will ask Justice Rogensack to come. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.